Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is Noah Webster remembered as a great lexicographer but not as an influential political thinker? Webster's name remains synonymous with the comprehensive American dictionary he spent 40 years perfecting. Updated editions have been in print for more than 150 years. But Webster's commitment to documenting American English and simplifying its spelling tend to overshadow his contributions to the strong federal government system that unified the United States in the late 18th and 19th centuries. Joshua Kendall is a freelance journalist and language enthusiast. His new book is called The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Josh, welcome to Think.
Pleasure to be on the line.
So Webster was always drawn to education, but if his dad had had his way, he would have just stayed on the family farm.
Yes. Webster was born in West Hartford in 1758, and he kept bugging his father to send him to Yale. And his brothers ended up becoming farmers, and they had very tough lives, dogged by poverty and depression. But Webster was the fortunate one, and he went to Yale and graduated in 1778, and that education, you know, made all the difference. And today he's best known for the dictionary, when he's known at all, especially here in Massachusetts. His distant cousin, Daniel, gets all the press. And a lot of people in the Bay State think that Daniel wrote the dictionary. But Noah, during his lifetime, was best known for his speller. And that came out in 1783, and he used his Yale education to write a book for school children. And that book was the Harry Potter of its day. in a population of 3 million, it sold 5,000 copies. In 1783, and over the next century, it would sell a staggering 100 million copies. So with these two books, The Speller and The Dictionary, Webster really cemented American English. He united us with a common language, and that's really his central legacy. We're the most ethnically diverse nation on the face of the earth, but we all speak a common language, and if you think about old Europe, France, or Italy, there's a different dialect every 20 miles. And in the 1780s, our language was really up for grabs. Everything was new, and if you think about it, English was really the language of the oppressor.
Yeah.
And there was a movement in the 1780s to speak something else. We had just gotten King George out of our face, and maybe we shouldn't speak the king's English. And some people were saying, well, maybe we should speak German. That was the Spanish of its day, the language number two, spoken by about 10% of the population, particularly those in Pennsylvania. And it was Webster's idea that we should speak English, but we shouldn't ask Englishmen, in his phrase, to license our words, that we should have our own language. And that's really a remarkable legacy. But as I say in the book, he's the forgotten founding father. People, if they do know about him, do know that he had something to do with words, but he had so many, he was a polymath, and he had his fingers in so many other aspects of American culture, the newspaper business, the publishing business, epidemiology. He inaugurated the field of public health. He was there at the Constitutional Convention, and he really was a major figure in American life who has been forgotten.
And just in his mid-20s, he had done enough influential things that none other than George Washington said, hey, let's come by and spend some time together because I want to pick your brain.
Yeah, well, Webster was brash, and he thought he knew everything. And sometimes he did. In the mid-1780s, he had just published The Speller, and he had an idea. He said, there's something fishy about this Articles of Confederation. The states have too much power. The federal government doesn't have enough power. So he writes a pamphlet, and then he says, I'm going to go to George Washington. Washington was then the first farmer. So he takes his horse, goes on his horse to Mount Vernon, and he shows it to Washington. Now, Washington, as opposed to Webster, who was a Yale man, James Madison, who was a Princeton guy, Adams, who was a Harvard guy, these were all Ivy Leaguers and also brilliant. Washington was a little bit out of his depth. He never went to college. So Webster hands him this pamphlet, and Washington is very impressed by Webster, but Washington is the expert delegator. He says, I like your pamphlet. your ideas are very interesting, and Webster's ideas were that we should have a stronger central government, and he was really one of the first people to articulate something like a constitution. So Washington says, okay, thank you, Mr. Webster, I'll pass it on to Mr. Madison. Hmm. And James Madison looks at it, and that is an impetus for the Constitutional Convention 2 years later.
And the idea of a strong federal government, I mean, now we sort of know it and we've lived with it for 200-plus years, but people forget, we think about the war between the states, but in fact, during the earliest days of the United States, the states weren't all that united. They were very separate from one another and didn't really have a national identity yet.
Right, and that's really his central achievement. I mean, so today, you know, there's so much gridlock in Washington. We can barely pass a budget. I mean, that's nothing new. I mean, in the 1780s, the fight was even worse. We were in a lot of debt because of the war, and the federal government didn't have the power to levy taxes. So that was up to the states, and some states collected revenue, and other states didn't. And Webster's idea was that we needed to unite, and part of it was with something called the Constitution. And he felt that if we could also have a national language, he once said a national language is a national tie, and what country needs it more than America? If we could have a national language, that could help us connect politically. And the amazing thing about America is we do have this national language, but it doesn't always do us any good politically. For instance, Jefferson Davis, the senator 100 years after Webster's birth in 1858, said, "We have a unity of language which no other people possess, and we owe this unity above all to Noah Webster's Yankee spelling book." Hmm. Webster's spelling book educated 5 generations of Americans. So this is 1858, right before the Civil War. So we've got a unity of language, but 3 years later we're killing each other. And the funny thing about the Civil War is that even though the South and the North were fighting, the South printed their own spellers. So they wanted to kill the North, but they also wanted to speak English the Webster way, and they used the speller changed for the present condition. So the speller was also a reader, so children would read sample sentences like the president's term is for 4 years, while in the Confederate speller it said the president's term is for 6 years. Hmm. So for Webster did cement the language, but and he also did give us this strong government, but some of those same tensions that we have today, political tensions, still persist, but they date back to what we had in the 1780s. And without Webster, they might have been even worse.
Josh, when Noah Webster was putting together his speller and then later his dictionary, were British English and American English as different as they are today? I mean, clearly we can all still understand each other on both sides of the Atlantic,
right,
but there are many different terms and ways of using language.
Right. Well, basically, there wasn't an American English. I mean, that the Americans, I mean, their dictionary was the dictionary of Samuel Johnson, and the Americans sort of felt funny about having anything that wasn't recognized by the Brits. So he was the person who said, if there's a word like squash that or chowder that, you know, the Brits don't recognize, you know, that's still, you know, that's part of our language, and we've got to start adding it in. So we could always understand each other. It's more a sense of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the speller was the speller previous to Webster's was written by a fellow named Thomas Dilworth. And for the illustrations, their sample sentences talked about cities and towns in Britain. And Webster, for the sample sentences, would use cities and towns in America. And it's really not that, I mean, American English is not that different. But the point is that it's ours, and and that we're the arbiters of our own language. And previous to that, we were just borrowing from the Brits. And Webster wanted us to feel proud of ourselves as Americans.
So in between publishing the speller and working on the dictionary, Noah Webster spent some time as a publisher of a newspaper called American Minerva. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Again, Webster has all these achievements, any one of which would be a lifetime achievement for anyone else. So in 1793, so he and Washington develop a close relationship. Washington is kind of a surrogate father. For Webster, Washington sees as kind of a personal policy wonk. When Washington arrives in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention, he calls on Webster for advice. And then several years later, in 1793, Washington gets Webster to start a Federalist newspaper. Those were the days when newspapers were partisan organs. And Webster starts this newspaper called the American Minerva. And the political issue of the 1790s, Washington wanted to steer clear of another war with England. The Jeffersonians were closely enamored of France and were considering trying to ally with France in a war against England. And Washington kept us out of a war with Webster's help. An interesting footnote is that Webster also was friendly with Alexander Hamilton, and Hamilton wrote for the American Minerva. But Hamilton and Webster then had a split in around 1798. That was the split that allowed Jefferson, a non-Federalist, to become president in 1800. And that paper, the New York Post, that you can pick up at a lot of drugstores across the country, that paper, the longest continuing daily paper, starts because Hamilton and Webster have a fight. Hamilton starts a rival paper in New York City in 1801.
So were people reading multiple newspapers back then, or did they stick with whatever reflected their views?
Yes, it's funny that they tended to read whatever reflected their views. And in a way, the present day scene with a lot of bloggers is sort of a back to the future moment, because Webster was the editor of the Minerva. It was a four-pager, and he wrote just about everything. And he's inserting a lot of his opinions. It's like a one-man blogger. And they're very highly partisan. The other side is evil. And it's like the blogosphere is almost the reincarnation of the newspapers of the 1790s.
So when did he start thinking that he wanted to do this dictionary?
Well, Webster always wanted to do the dictionary. And that's a big difference between Webster and Samuel Johnson. Samuel Johnson, the great British lexicographer, took on the dictionary because it paid. He had the sensibility of a poet, and he once said, "No one but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." But Webster, he makes money with his speller. His speller, again, is the Harry Potter of its day. It sells 100 million copies. I mean, not all during Webster's lifetime, about 13 million during his lifetime. It's selling like crazy. He's making money, and he decides he just loves compiling and organizing information. And he retires at the age of 40, and he retires from the newspaper business, and he moves to New Haven, and he moves into the fanciest house in town, and he gets a good deal on it because this house used to belong to Benedict Arnold.
And nobody wanted it.
No one wanted it. He gets a good deal. It's got fancy columns. I looked at the deed, and it also has two outhouses. That second outhouse is a fancy accoutrement translated into number of bathrooms today with heated toilet seats or whatever the 21st century spin is. He moves into Benedict Arnold's house, and he can't wait to do the dictionary. And no one wanted the dictionary because Samuel Johnson was considered a giant. And even though we got rid of the Brits, people were very attached to Samuel Johnson. And he actually has to take on Samuel Johnson and Samuel Johnson Jr. And this is a funny story, that there was one American lexicographer before Webster, and his name was Samuel Johnson Jr. No relation, but it's a perfect name for a publicist or for a publisher. So Webster takes on Johnson and Johnson Jr. and really spends the next 40 years of his life working on various editions of his dictionary.
My guest this hour is Joshua Kendall. He's a freelance journalist and language enthusiast. His new book is called The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joshua Kendall. He's a freelance journalist whose new book is called The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Josh, we should say that before Noah Webster got down in earnest to working on the dictionary, he tried very hard to be the first official biographer of George Washington and didn't get the gig.
Yeah, Washington was a father figure for Webster, and he had didn't have a great relationship with his own father. His father was a farmer, and his father really couldn't support him either financially or emotionally, and he always looked up to Washington. Washington dies suddenly in 1799, and I just had a chance to read the newspapers of the day, and everyone was shocked, and the whole nation was in tears. Webster was devastated, and he applies to Washington's nephew, a fellow named Bushrod Washington, and he wants to become the first official presidential biographer, and he doesn't get the gig. It goes to a fellow named John Marshall, who becomes the Chief Justice, and Webster is kind of looking for what to do. He's in the Arnold House, and he has a couple of, for him, small projects, but for anyone else, massive projects. And he loves compiling and organizing information. And before he starts in the dictionary, he writes a brief treatise on epidemiology. Now, brief for Webster means 700 pages. This is kind of also forgotten today, but in the 1790s, there was probably the most serious public health epidemic in American history, which was the yellow fever. And to give you a sense of the dimensions of the yellow fever, 5,000 people died in Philadelphia in a few months in 1793. That's literally decimating the population. The government had to move, Washington had to move out of Philadelphia, and the fever comes back in 1795 when Webster is the editor of New York City's daily newspaper, and he he does what he can, which is to compile information, and he drafts the world's first scientific survey. He gets a lot of data, and then when he moves into the Arnold House, he starts crunching the data and writes this 700-page treatise on epidemics. At the same time, he loved also crunching temperature. He loved taking the temperature a couple of times a day, and that's an obsession that he shared with Thomas Jefferson. And he and Jefferson then would have a vigorous debate on a contemporary topic, global warming. Webster writes an essay on global warming. There were no cars, obviously, then, but the issue is what's happening to the climate with the forests being cut down. So he does a couple of other scientific projects, and then around 1800 gets down to the dictionary. And no one is really interested because everyone loves Samuel Johnson. But Webster, again, he's not doing it for the money. He does it because he loves it. And the first thing he does is he replaces that fellow Samuel Johnson Jr. Johnson Jr. had written a brief dictionary, and this was a brief dictionary, not a 700-page brief dictionary. And Webster then writes a brief dictionary, and in the brief dictionary called a compendious dictionary, comes out in 1806. And that has one-word definitions, kind of looks like a contemporary thesaurus. Mm-hmm. So he writes that first small dictionary, and that's a warm-up for the big dictionary that he's going to spend the next two decades on, and that's first published in 1828.
And he was actually, if he had a greatest gift, it seems to have been really crystallizing what particular words meant.
Yes. Johnson, Webster was precise, and he had this razor-sharp analytic mind. And also, he was a polymath, and he read everything. And Johnson's dictionary, the edition Webster was working with, was published in 1799, and it didn't really have the terminology of the Enlightenment. Physics and chemistry and biology and all these sciences were coming into their own, and Webster was very good about incorporating those words into the English language. I had the chance to look at that 1799 edition of Johnson, and Johnson was sort of his base. Webster would add a lot of things, and one of the funny things about it is that Johnson relied on Shakespeare a lot, and Webster hated Shakespeare And that may have something to do with his education, because Webster was educated at Yale in the 1770s, where drama was considered two steps away from sex. The students were penalized for putting on plays or attending plays, and Webster, he doesn't use Shakespeare, but he blames Shakespeare, so he doesn't quote Shakespeare much, but for dirty words like a whore or something, he would just say shack, S-H-A-K, as if Shakespeare was responsible for the dirty words in the world. So he had these kind of little idiosyncratic touches, but I think what he really did was the definitions were fantastic. And also, for the quotations, he doesn't use Shakespeare, but he uses American writers. And quoting Samuel Johnson in the preface, he says, "A chief glory of a nation is its writers." So he uses Washington, Madison, and Jay to illustrate terms like constitutionality. And what he really is doing is showing to the world that American literature belongs on the world stage. And with the 1828 dictionary, the world got to see that America has its own authors. And by 1828, really, American culture had arrived. We don't have great epic poets like John Milton, but we have great constitutional theorists, and the Federalist Papers were a brilliant document, and that's something we can be very proud of, and Webster certainly was.
So when Webster's first real dictionary comes out in 1828 with the full definitions, it is critically acclaimed, but it doesn't sell worth a darn.
Well, the big dictionaries have never sold as well. So they print 2,500 copies, and it takes about a decade to sell. To this day, I mean, Merriam-Webster Company has a huge dictionary, but what really sells, at least until the digital age, which is shaking everything up, was always the collegiate dictionary. But in Webster's day, his abridged dictionaries would sell, but his heart was in the unabridged. He loved compiling, and to the horror of his family, at the age of 80, he mortgages his second house in New Haven and works on a second edition that he publishes at the age of 83, and he's still going until the day he dies in 1843. I saw his word list toward the end of his life. There are words like puritanically, and he's sticking in. And that's what he loves to do, is compile and organize words. And again, the dictionary for him was a labor of love.
And it appears he dropped in a few words that he coined himself.
Well, he only coined one word himself, which he had picked up in New York City, which was demoralized from the French. But the dictionary is part autobiography, and he is sticking himself in there. In 1808, he had a religious conversion, so he had a lot, and he became a born-again Christian. So he has a lot of Christian theology in there. I mean, he defines marriage as covenant between man, woman, and God. And his personal experience is sneaking in. When Webster was about 22, he eventually married later and had a wife and seven children. But when he was about 22, he met a woman named Rebecca, and the love affair went awry. And Saturday Review quipped, because Webster did keep a copious diary, which I was able to lean on a lot, but he doesn't talk about this love affair. But Saturday Review quipped about 100 years later, it took him a whole dictionary to express his feelings. And he's sticking in, one of his daughters dies young, and he uses her as an example. So there's a lot of personal stuff in the dictionary. And that was cleaned out by the Merriam-Webster Company in 1864, when they published a massive dictionary, which was the first modern English dictionary that you could recognize that was objective and, you know, wholly evidence-based. Webster's dictionary is part literary and part sort of philologically sound. It's sort of a hybrid, and the 1864 dictionary, as I've written in a recent piece for The Nation, was really the first draft of the Oxford English Dictionary. And people forget today that American lexicography in the 19th century was really the best English lexicography in the world. And New Haven, where Webster was located, was really the world capital of English lexicography. And Webster's dictionary throughout the 19th century, the OED, isn't finished until 1928. throughout the 19th century was the most authoritative dictionary in both America and in England. So Webster was really a world-class lexicographer, and although he had a couple of odd notions, his etymologies weren't very good, he basically started this tradition that Americans should be very proud of, and really we aren't proud enough of how good our lexicographers are and have been.
You mentioned his family, and he did love them, but he was not really an easy guy to live with.
Yes, Webster, and this was a little bit heartbreaking. He was very tough on his wife and his children. I argue that he had obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. Now, that's not the same as OCD. People with OCD often can't function. They're so anxious about burning down the house because they're afraid that they left a burner on. Webster had a personality. He was obsessional. He loved order, rules, and lists. He was very inflexible, and he could be very difficult to deal with. And I did a piece for Psychology Today about obsessive-compulsive personality disorder and interviewed therapists, and they said that people with this disorder rarely come to treatment, but they're the type of people who drive everyone else in the family into treatment. And Webster's wife was long-suffering. His son was a ne'er-do-well. He went to Yale but couldn't graduate, and had an alcohol and depression problem. And you had a sense that being Webster's son was no picnic. But for Webster and for people with obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, if they find an outlet like lexicography or maybe law or accounting, or if they find some passion, they do okay, and they function at a very high level, but they can be very tough on their family, and I have a sense that he was always yelling. He might not have yelled at the children per se, but one of the children in a kind of heartbreaking note said, "Papa makes me shiver like a top." And I have a sense that he could be very difficult. And I think part of the reason he's forgotten is that he's actually alienated historians, because we like to think of our founders as people like Washington, who are just men of integrity. Webster had a lot of personal integrity, but he was kind of flying off the handle a lot and would say a lot of silly things. Like when he turned 50, he said, "Well, no man under 45 should be allowed to vote." just kind of ridiculous. And I had a hard time. And one famous historian said he wanted to write a biography of Webster, but he hated him too much. And I sort of feel like there's an analogy here in Boston baseball. We used to have this player named Manny Ramirez who would do strange things like walk into the wall at Fenway Park during a break or something. And the writers would say, "Well, that's just Manny being Manny." And I feel like with Webster, if I just sort of understood him as Noah being Noah, that he would say these silly things and understood his struggle, that he becomes a more lovable and even likable figure, and in a way even charming. And I think that's the struggle of a biographer, is to capture someone in all his complexity. And I tried to, and I just went wherever the evidence took me, but that he was very difficult in the family, but he also was a brilliant lexicographer and a major contributor. And people are very complicated, and especially with the founding fathers or historical figures in general. I think biographers have a tendency to either idealize or, with some figures, to demonize. And I think just people are very complicated, and they can have wonderful, I think people, especially people like Webster, a lot of high achievers are fragmented, and they have different parts, and some of the parts are fantastic, and you know, Webster knew exactly what he was talking about with the Constitution, and it was just incredible achievements, and some of the parts are a little bit off, or some of them can be even a little bit nasty. Webster had a great friend from college, an early well-known American poet by the name of Joel Barlow, and they were buddies for 30 years. And after his religious conversion, Webster wrote him a nastygram saying, "I never want to talk to you again because you're an atheist." And Webster could be so self-absorbed, 2.5 years later, he asked Barlow for a favor. Barlow then, and he pretends as if nothing ever happened. And but some people are like that. And I think it's hard, especially for young people, to take in that we can have a hero in our country. And Webster is definitely a hero. I mean, he did some amazing things. But we can have some heroes who, you know, are not always likable, or all parts of them are not likable.
He did have really progressive ideas, particularly for his day, about education, public education in general, and education of girls in particular.
Yes, and what's remarkable about Webster is that he was very crotchety, and he, you know, seemed to lack empathy in his personal life. And maybe some, you know, people have said that sometimes people, political figures are like that, but on the page, he had a lot, and conceptually, he had a lot of empathy. He wrote an early treatise against slavery in the 1790s. He was a progressive, and he really wanted girls to become educated. And his speller, he really empathized with children, because in those days, children would be whacked in school, and he really wanted children to be treated respectfully. And his speller was very clear, and he wanted to connect with children. And his dictionary is very clear, and on the page, and sometimes he can be really witty on the page. And he wrote a series of essays like in the manner of Poor Richard's Almanac, because Franklin was really his model, which were just very witty and funny and really connecting with the reader. But in person, I have a sense that he's not someone, you know, you could really have a conversation with. I imagine at a dinner party, he would just kind of be fulminating. But on the page, he could be very pleasant, and conceptually, he could have a lot of empathy for the downtrodden. In the 1790s, he was part of a Hartford Charitable Society that promoted unemployment insurance. I mean, this was 150 years before the New Deal. But later in his life, he became very reactionary. He said, we're a wicked people. So he's kind of all over the map, but part of him really went to bat for the downtrodden and for people like women who didn't really get a fair shake in that society.
My guest is journalist Joshua Kendall. His new book is called The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Joshua Kendall. His new book is called The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send a question via email to think@kera.org. Josh, we haven't really talked about this despite mentioning the speller and the dictionary, but it's such an interesting element in this story. If Samuel Johnson essentially standardized English spelling, Noah Webster set out to reform it because there was a lot of junk in there that he thought was ridiculous.
Yeah, English spelling in the 17th century, words were constantly spelled differently. It started to get standardized around 1700. 1721 is the first major English dictionary by a guy by the name of Bailey. Johnson, as you say, standardizes it. But Webster actually goes through, again, I was talking before about him having different parts and he could be very contradictory. He actually goes through a couple of different, he's obsessed with spelling. And again, he's an obsessive compulsive, and what he really wants to do is create order. And basically, language is a mess, and you can never create order. And he's got about four or five different schemes. He writes a book in 1790 where he leaves out the E's, so he'll spell fugitive. It's called Fugitive Essays, and he'll spell fugitive IV, and he thought that's the way, and he gave that up after a couple of years. But what he really wants to do is in spelling is to kind of be efficient, and So that ends up leaving out the hues in color. Actually, for my next book, I'm doing a series of essays about various obsessives in American culture, from Thomas Jefferson to Melville Dewey. And Melville Dewey, the librarian, the Dewey Decimal System, mm-hmm. also was part of the spelling reform movement. And Dewey also wanted, and they, like Webster, it was to try to use a shorthand, to use fewer letters. And some of these spelling reformers, like Webster and Dewey, they're almost like tweeters today, because they're really interested in efficiency. And, you know, there's just this inherent contradiction, because language is always messy. And I think the English language is basically one of the messiest around, because English, as opposed to French, let's say, we have so many different languages that flow into English. We've got the Germanic side, we've got the Romance side, and it's basically a mess. And Webster had various different ideas, and he had to give up the IV thing after a couple of years. And he and Ben Franklin wanted to change the alphabet for a while in the 1780s.
Yeah, Franklin had actual different characters that he wanted to insert.
Right. So these various schemes, and then Webster also, at one point, he wanted to spell women, W-I-M-E-N, going back to the Anglo-Saxon, and that's listed as an alternative spelling in the 1828 dictionary. And so he kind of goes back and forth, and the things that got codified are those Americanized versions of the British, so theater, ER, defense,
SE instead of CE.
Right. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that stuck. But he was all over the place. And underneath it all was this obsession with, and I start the book with an epigraph that he says something like, if I was at all successful in getting rid of the errors in language, that it will be seen by my influence on the rising generation. I mean, he wanted to, but of course, you're never going to get, language is just very, very messy. Mm-hmm. And I think language is sort of part of life. Life is always complicated, and you can't, but for an obsessive, the challenge is to clean it out. And that's what kind of compelled him to write and to keep on writing.
We have an email here, Josh, from Norman in Dallas, who wants to know, do we have Noah Webster to thank for shortening amongst and whilst to among and while? And do you have an opinion about why some Americans have readopted the practice of saying amongst rather than among, but not saying whilst instead of while?
Yeah, I don't know about that. That's a very good question. I mean, that does sound like it would be a Webster touch, but off the top of my head, I don't know.
Is there anything in his journals about his process while he was working? And did he write about trying to decide whether or not to spell gray with an A-Y or an E-Y, and how he sort of thought through some of these problems?
Yeah, the manuscripts, I looked at as many, I went to manuscript libraries from Massachusetts to Washington, D.C., and he doesn't really, I think that there's no complete draft of the dictionary, which is a little disappointing. I think what happened was that the family, to raise money in the late 19th century, started selling off pages for cash. I was excited to find the first page of the dictionary, and it was in a small museum in New Haven, and the last biographer had missed it, and it was kind of exciting because it has a date. So he writes the small dictionary in 1806, and then on November 3rd, 1807, he starts the dictionary. And surprise, surprise, the dictionary begins with A. And that day, he just writes out what A is. It's the first letter of the alphabet, and he writes a whole bunch of stuff about it. And that is very close to what was put in the dictionary 20 years later. But it's really, and then he does A and B. And I make a joke about it in the book, because he thinks it's going to take 5 years or 10 years. And I say, well, writing a dictionary, especially by oneself, always takes longer than you think. So it keeps going on and on. And then he did one letter and then another, and then he sort of files it away. Mm-hmm. And then in 1808, he has this religious conversion, And then he decides that he wants to write the mother of all etymologies. He believes that all languages can be traced back to the language of Noah, his biblical namesake, and he spends 10 years on this etymology. It's 1,000 pages, and that draft is perfectly preserved in the basement of the New York Public Library. It's never been published because it's gibberish. And Webster was very arrogant, and he always thought he was right, and sometimes he really was. And in the 1780s, he was absolutely right about the Constitution, and he was essential in helping Washington. But with the etymology, he thought he was right, and he wasn't. His grandiosity had kind of gotten the best of him. And he just had one speculative idea that he would back up with another speculative idea, and he spends 10 years on it. And James Murray, the first editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, who had enormous respect for Webster, who said he was a great man, a born definer of words, said that the etymology is a history of fact. And Webster's etymology was, in fact, it was speculation. And he spends 10 years on it, and that's the part he was most proud of. But then he has to go back to see, and then he systematically goes through the alphabet. And then in 1824, he's about done. And this is a chapter that previous biographers have downplayed, but in the 1820s, he's about done, and he goes to Europe, and still no one is interested in the dictionary. And he's having a crisis. He's having a hard time finding a publisher. And Webster was a very canny businessman, and he decides to change his model drastically. And he said he goes to England, and he decides that he wants to write a universal dictionary that will be valid in both America and England. And he decides to set up a conference between Oxford, Cambridge, and him to decide what English should be. And Oxford and Cambridge aren't buying. So he was willing to give up his idea of an American dictionary, but that doesn't fly. And then he does some research in England. He actually finishes the book in England. And if he had been successful, the Brits and the Americans would be speaking the same language today. But then he changes course, goes back to his original idea, and then the American Dictionary is published in 1828.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Gary in Rowlett. Hi, Gary.
Hi. First, I wanted to say that I think this is a great show, and I wish everybody would listen to it, this particular edition. Secondly, I heard you say that the Constitution gave the federal government more strength, which makes sense to me, and yet I often hear people use the Constitution as a way of saying that states have more rights. So I'm wondering if you get that from people and how you address that.
Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for your call. I guess in the 1780s, America was, the states had tremendous power. For instance, the federal government could not collect taxes, and there were we had a lot of debt from the Revolution, and there was a major there was basically an economic meltdown because we couldn't pay off this debt, and some of the states were raising money and others didn't. So the Constitution does give the national government more authority. And it's funny to read Webster on the Constitution because the one thing he really likes about the Constitution, and he writes an essay about it in 1787, is he really likes the definitions. And what he talks about is that the Constitution is very clear about what the states can do and what the federal government can do. But I guess, as you're saying, the Constitution does sort of state what does declare clearly what the state authority is. So the states still have some power. But the point is that under the Articles of Confederation, the national government was very weak. And Webster's famous phrase that he writes about in his pamphlet and takes to Washington, our confederation is but a cobweb. And so the Constitution cements the federal government, but it still allots certain responsibilities to the states. And I think that's why it's a brilliant document, and because it doesn't, again, as Webster would say, it's just very clear. In who has what authority.
How did editing and updating of the dictionary continue after Webster's death?
Right. So the dictionary comes out. Webster dies in 1844. Then the Merriam-Webster Company, then was the GNC Merriam Company, takes over. And I wrote this long piece in The Nation about this 1864 dictionary, which was the first modern English dictionary. And then it becomes a team effort. And Webster is Webster and Johnson are one-man shows. It's funny, Webster has one assistant on the 1828 dictionary, and he can't get along with him when he fires him. He's also an eccentric, a Yale guy who's even more eccentric than Webster, and he attempted suicide, and he was another difficult character. But the 1864 dictionary, because knowledge is increasing so rapidly that basically, and the funny thing about the 1864 dictionary is that it's the Yale faculty. It's about half of the Yale faculty then has 30 professors, and about half of them are involved in the dictionary because it becomes just too much for one man. In Webster's last dictionary, 1841, he relies on a few experts, but I think, and that's also the difference between knowledge in Webster's day and knowledge today, is just there's so much more information out there. And what's so exciting about working on someone like Webster is that those were the days of the polymaths. Webster, we haven't even talked about some of his other contributions, and this treatise on public health, or just alluded to quickly, but so many other fields that he could go into. And by the 1850s, you really need experts in all these fields, and those experts become part of the dictionary.
I have to ask, before this, you wrote The Man Who Made Lists, which is, of course, about Peter Marc Roget, and now you're moving on to another book about people who are obsessed. What is your obsession with obsessives?
I guess I'm obsessed with the obsessed. I'm not an obsessive myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not an order freak, but I guess I'm just I just find it so fascinating because I think I just remember when I was in college, and I went to Yale, and I can kind of, that's part of my connection with Webster that had a big influence on me. Just the brilliant professors, but I just remember sort of idealizing my professors and. Just to sort of really get inside the heads and to see that these people can be really brilliant, but they can also be kind of quirky. And I think that's, and I think especially young people, we tend to idealize brilliant minds mm-hmm. or political leaders. And it's kind of exciting just to see that they're human beings in a struggle and some of their behavior can be brilliant, some of their ideas can be brilliant, but they can also have a lot of quirks.
Joshua Kendall's new book is The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Josh, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.